He's got 7 heads, I think, and 10 crowns and 10 horns. And the red head is the one that's been fatally wounded but comes back to life. He's supposed to have legs like a leopard, but that doesn't really look like a leopard to me. Maybe a tail like a scorpion. Anyway, none of that's the point. That was just for entertainment value. The Beast from Revelation, if you remember, is where John talks about Satan having the power to bring forth these two beasts. And this one seems to be sort of the power to create political systems which will distract or distort people's view of God. So this is how it works. John says that the beast, he calls it Babylon, and that's why we're looking at Daniel, because Daniel ended up living in Babylon. And the idea is that Babylon is a political system that that warped people's view of God, that distracted people from God. But actually, John in Revelation is talking about Rome, because that's the political system, the empire that's in charge at the time that he's writing. And kind of implicitly in what he's writing, partly through the it was killed and then it came back, it was Babylon, now it's Rome, there's also the implication that that this is going to keep happening until Jesus comes back. It's going to keep happening until God brings about his kingdom fully in the world. So in that sense, people have thought of the beast being not only Babylon and then Rome, but also other political systems that follow. You might say things like Nazi Germany or communist Russia or Pol Pot's Cambodia or Idi Amin's Uganda or even Mugabe's Zimbabwe, where the political system is a dangerous one, one that warps the view that God has of the world. But you might also, and we looked at this last week, you might also say that in different ways, systems like our own Western capitalist democratic system also, in different ways, warps people's view of God and kind of moves them away from the way that God would want them to, or want us to be living. So last week I was saying that we'd be looking at Daniel for a couple of weeks, and I think Sam's going to do that next week too. And specifically looking at Daniel, and I had two questions last week. Obviously that's not the questions, this is my map. The questions were, well, what was it like to live in Babylon? When John is trying to call up this image of Babylon in people's mind when they're reading Revelation, what does he mean by that? How do people view Babylon? And then secondly, how did Daniel in particular and his friends, how did they cope with that? What were their, what was it like to live in Babylon, I suppose? I forget the laser here. Oh, just doing this for my benefit, not yours. There's Babylon. There's Jerusalem. This is what it looks like if you whiz it around. Oh, yeah. It's good, isn't it? And I was just saying last week about how Daniel was a long way from home. He was in a foreign culture and in a foreign situation. And we saw last week that Daniel accepted some of the things about Babylon, but had some idea about where he was going to draw the line. He was going to accept a new name, but he wasn't going to take food off the king's table, maybe because it was about a conflict of loyalty. And I mentioned last week, this is kind of important to chapter 3 where we are today, that it all turns out well for him. And in fact, in chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar, the emperor, has this this dream which really upsets him, and he wants his advisors to interpret the dream. And they say, fine, yeah, okay, well, give it a go. Tell us the dream, and we'll get on to it. And he says, no, this is so important, I'm not going to tell you the dream. You all have to work it out. Which, obviously, they say, that's impossible. And what happens is that God gives Daniel the dream, and he interprets it, and this is one of the ways in which we see Daniel being used by God in that kingdom. The dream was about a big statue, and the statue was gold. I think it had a golden head, and then a silver body, and then sort of bronze upper legs, and its lower legs are kind of clay mixed with iron. Well, they were weaker anyway. And there's a big ball, which is probably Jesus, the kingdom of God, comes in and smashes the statue at its base, and it falls over. And Daniel says, good news, Nebuchadnezzar. You're the golden bit at the top. And what this statue signifies is four kingdoms to come one after the other, each a little bit weaker than the last, and eventually God's going to undermine it. But you're the golden one, you're the best of them all, and you're coming first. So happy days for you. Now that feeds into chapter 3 because, partly because it kind of establishes Daniel, but also because it sows a seed in Nebuchadnezzar's mind. And today we're going to look at how that plays out. Here's the start of chapter 3. King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold, 90 feet high and 9 feet wide, and set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. He then summoned the satraps, prefects, governors, advisors, treasurers, judges, magistrates, and all the other provincial officials to come to the dedication of the image he had set up. Now, actually, I didn't even say that, but we're pretty confident that this image is of Nebuchadnezzar. Maybe it looked like that. Probably it didn't look much like that, because 90 feet high, I've been trying to work it out this morning, 90 feet high, maybe it's about three times as tall as this building. It's about the size of, we reckon, kind of a medium-sized tree, Keith? Do you think? Medium-sized tree? We were looking at trees the other day. How? It's difficult. I think it's about half the height of the clock tower on the Civic Centre. But it's tricky because that was in metres and this is in feet. But anyway, quite tall. Not that wide, really. 9 feet wide. So it's probably more of a sort of kind of an obelisk. But he sets it up. It's overlaid with gold. Probably kind of thinking, oh, the dream. Yes, God says, I'm gold. Ah, gold. Ah, gold. Statue of gold. And I'll call all the people. The significance of the list of people, I can't remember what they all mean, but they're kind of in order of importance. And these are the people, like the movers and shakers of Babylon. So here you might talk about your cabinet ministers and MPs and judges and I don't know who else really. I don't know. I can't think of anything funny. Anyway, there we go. Oh, I read something. It's probably about the size of a very large palm tree. And I don't know if that's helpful. So, the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the advisors, the treasurers, the judge, the magistrates, all these important people, and all the provincial officials assembled for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And they stood before it. Then the herald loudly proclaimed, "This is what you are to do, O peoples, nations, and men of every language. As soon as you hear the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipes, and all kinds of music, you must fall down and worship the image of gold that Nebuchadnezzar has set up. Whoever does not fall down and worship will immediately be thrown into a blazing furnace." Therefore, as soon as they heard the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, and all kinds of music, all the peoples, nations, and men of every language, all these important people, but also everyone else, fell down and worshipped the image of gold that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. It's important to mention at this point, because it becomes quite relevant, is that Babylon is a place where it was perfectly normal and expected that you would worship more than one god. We kind of saw that last week with the names that Daniel and his friends were given. Daniel's called Belteshazzar, which was after the god of Bel. All the others, Abednego was after the god Nego. I can't remember the other two, but it was after the god Aku, I think. Shadrach, that's not in there, but I think it's after, it's three gods between the four names. And so falling down in front and worshipping this image that Nebuchadnezzar has made up, he wouldn't see that as being unreasonable. He's not asking people to give up their religion and join in this one. He would just see this as being something that's, you know, another little pot in the mix. And another little side dish on the buffet that they could dip into. And that if you didn't, that was being unreasonable. It's not unreasonable to set up the image. Haha, but at this time, some astrologers came forward and denounced the Jews. They said to King Nebuchadnezzar, O king, live forever. This is the way to butter up the king, I guess. You have issued a decree, O king, that everyone who hears the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipes, and all kinds of music must fall down and worship the image of gold, and that whoever does not fall down and worship will be thrown into a blazing furnace. But there are some Jews whom you have set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who pay no attention to you, O king. They neither serve your gods nor worship the image of gold you've set up. So, obviously, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego choose not to, because for them, serving the one god, there is more of an issue than for the other Babylonians. Maybe these astrologers are upset. It seems quite personal, doesn't it? They sort of come along and say, he's not worshipping the image. And they seem to sort of exaggerate as well. These people pay no attention to you. They never listen to anything you say. And look what they're doing. So it seems like quite a personal attack on them. For reasons we don't know. Perhaps upset that they've got jobs above them. The other thing we don't know is what happened to Daniel. Chapter 1, Daniel. Chapter 2, Daniel. Chapter 4, Daniel. Chapter 3, no Daniel. But we don't know. So. Maybe he's ill. Maybe he was away on holiday. Suddenly, the woman whose commentary I was reading said perhaps he was just too important to be mentioned. I don't know about that. Alan agrees with that. Alan says yes. So I guess that's the truth. So thanks, Alan. Sorry about that. I shouldn't have. Well, we don't know, basically. This page is blank. I don't know why. Furious with rage, Nebuchadnezzar summons Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So these men were brought before the king, and Nebuchadnezzar said to them, "Is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the image of gold I have set up? Now then, when you hear the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipes, and all kinds of music, if you are ready to fall down and worship the image I made, very good. But if you don't worship, you'll be thrown immediately into a blazing furnace. Then what God will be able to rescue you from my hands?" We're beginning to get perhaps to where we answer our two questions. What's Babylon like? I think here we see quite a good shot of it, really. Nebuchadnezzar has made this image. He thinks it's perfectly reasonable to ask people to worship it. But these Jews have chosen not to. And they're brought before him. Notice, number one, he's furious. Why is he furious? He's furious maybe partly because of an ego thing. He wants everyone to worship him, and they're not. But also, remember that he doesn't think it's unreasonable. He's furious because he sees this as treason. He doesn't really understand that these Jews would consider it, is completely no-no for them to worship another god. So he sees what they're doing as a betrayal of him and all that he stands for. And I think that's important when you're thinking about what is Babylon like, what are other political systems like. There is a sort of lack of understanding, I think, of other positions within it, and an assumption that everyone is going to think and believe and react in the same way. Secondly, notice that although he's furious and although he considers it treason, actually he's quite reasonable with them, isn't he? He's not going to just throw them in the fire because he's heard his astrologers say that they don't bow down. He's not just going to ask them point. He's giving them a second chance. So it's not necessarily the case that all political systems, and I think this is important for us, it's not the case that all political systems are tyrannical, that they're all out to persecute just for no reason, that they're all out to kind of knee-jerk and stick the boot in. He thinks, Nebuchadnezzar thinks, that he is doing what is right and fair and just. And in a sense, he kind of is. So he gives them a chance. But also, notice at the end, his last sentence, which I think is revealing and again looks back at what we said last week. He says, "Then what God will be able to rescue you from my hand?" We saw last week in chapter 1 how there was this assumption of how Nebuchadnezzar and his God were supreme, that they could do what they wanted, that they were sovereign. And again, you kind of see that there, don't you? He's saying, gods are all equal, I'm equal with the gods, I'm the king, I can do what I like. No one's going to save you. It's all down to me. So again, I think this is something that perhaps we see when we look at other political systems, that they don't recognize, obviously, they don't recognize that they are under a sovereign God. We'll come back to that later on. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied to the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we don't need to defend ourselves before you in this matter. If we're thrown into the blazing furnace, the God we serve is able to save us from it, and he will rescue us from your hand, O king. But even if he does not, we want you to know, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold you've set up. I think this is one of the most impressive little speeches in the whole of the Bible. It's just amazing, isn't it? That you're so good. I put some bits in bold. There are two things in particular, I think, that are worth picking out and just admiring, really. The first one is that we don't need to defend ourselves before you in this matter. Isn't that amazing that they're stood before the king, the person who holds the power of life or death over them, and say, well, we're not going to argue about this. I think there are two things to spot here. First of all, the king is furious, and I think it's probably quite wise of them not to try and debate the point with them. They don't get sucked into a theological debate over something that the king just isn't. Maybe he would never bend to it anyway, but he's certainly not in an emotional position to start talking, oh yes, I see your point on that. So there's kind of a wisdom there, and if we're thinking about how we respond to the society around us, I think there's a choice to be made on points. You know, do we need to explain these things, or do we just need to say, sorry, you know, this is how it is? And secondly, we don't need to defend ourselves. The reason they don't need to defend themselves before the king is because they're seeing beyond the king to God. And in a sense, and this is what Shane Claiborne's book is all about, Jesus is their president. Of course, they don't know who Jesus is and they don't have a president. But you kind of get the idea. God is their king. I find it difficult to translate Jesus president thing into English as well, because Jesus is our prime minister. Doesn't have the same ring. And Jesus is our queen. This doesn't work on all sorts of levels. So, but anyway, that's the sort of thing they're saying, is that Jesus, God, rather, for them, is their king. Not you, Nebuchadnezzar. We'll defend ourselves to God. Secondly, God could save us from this fire, but even if he doesn't, we'll go into it. I think this is amazing, as a man of little courage. They'll do what's right, even if it's going to cost them their life. And I say that seriously. I mean, how often do I pull out of things because I think that's going to be difficult, or that's going to make me miss my train, that's going to cost me a bit of time, that's going to lead to a debate I don't really want to have, it's going to cost me money, I'm going to have to give up something there. It never gets anywhere near me getting burnt or killed, obviously. And yet I'm willing to pull out. And they're willing to say, well, God could save us, but even if he doesn't, that's okay with us. We'd rather be true to God. I think it's very impressive. So we'll look at what happened, and then we'll come back to what we learned from it. Then, as you might expect, Nebuchadnezzar was furious, even more furious, perhaps, with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and his attitude toward them changed. I think it just got worse, actually. He ordered the furnace heated 7 times hotter than usual, which probably just means a lot hotter than usual, and commanded some of the strongest soldiers in his army to tie up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. I'm just going to move on. And throw them into the blazing fire. So these men, wearing their robes, trousers, turbans, and other clothes. They live in the desert. Why are they wearing all that? Wearing all their clothes, they were bound and thrown into the blazing furnace. The king's command was so urgent and the furnace so hot that the flames of the fire killed the soldiers who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these 3 men, firmly tied, fell into the blazing furnace. Then King Nebuchadnezzar leapt to his feet in amazement and asked his advisers, weren't there 3 men that we tied up and threw into the fire? They replied, certainly, O king. He said, look, I see 4 men walking around in the fire, unbound and unharmed, and the 4th looks like a son of the gods. Nebuchadnezzar then approached the opening of the blazing furnace and shouted, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out. Come here. So Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out of the fire, And don't know what happened to the fourth person. And the maybe that was Daniel. Who knows? Probably not, though. And the satraps, prefects, he was in there all along, hiding in the fire. He wasn't, I'm sorry. They came out, and the satraps, prefects, governors, and royal advisors crowded around them. They saw that the fire had not harmed their bodies, nor was a hair on their head singed, their robes were not scorched, and there was no smell of fire on them. That's amazing, isn't it? Probably it looked just like this. Probably not, actually. Then Nebuchadnezzar said, "Praise be to the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and rescued his servants. They trusted in him and defied the king's command and were willing to give up their lives rather than serve or worship any god except their own god. Therefore, I decree that the people of any nation or language who say anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego..." I don't think he's quite got it here. it's not really a Jesus message. "Be cut into pieces, and their houses be turned into piles of rubble. For no other god can save in this way." Actually, it is interesting. If you read the book of Daniel, you kind of see Nebuchadnezzar through the chapter. And if you read chapter 4, by the end of chapter 4, he almost seems to be getting it more. And arguably has got it. But here, clearly impressed, but perhaps not converted. Then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. So it all turns out well. Now, what can we learn from Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego? I think we learn three things, really. First of all, they saw God as their emperor, not Nebuchadnezzar. Remember the thing about, we don't need to defend ourselves before you. And I was thinking about how do we link this through? Well, actually, this is something that we also see in the New Testament. For instance, Paul talks quite a lot about Jesus being Lord. I might even find something in Philippians 2. Going the wrong way. Should have found this before. This is Philippians chapter 2. I'll take from verse 9. God exalted Jesus to the highest place and gave him the name that is above every name, that at the name of Jesus every knee should bow, and in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue that confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father. Seems quite uncontroversial to us, but at the time in the Roman Empire, this was very subversive, because the title that that Caesar took is Caesar is Lord, and this was a sort of a common greeting or a common thing that was spoken. Caesar is Lord. So to go around saying no, Jesus is Lord, is exactly the same type of thing that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are doing here. They're saying, "Sorry, we can't worship your image because you're not really our king and God. God is our king and God." And it's the same sort of thing that gets, in fact, it kind of gets Jesus into trouble with the, with Pilate, that's his name. This is the way that the Sanhedrin eventually are able to say, "You should execute him. He's saying that he's a king." It's not so much the religious stuff that bothers Pilate, it's the political thing. And then also with Paul as well, one of the things that gets him into trouble is this message of, "We're not serving Caesar, we're serving Jesus." You see it as well in Revelation, with the mark of the beast, where, again, we saw this when we looked at Revelation, that John talks about everyone getting a mark of the beast, and probably, and this is in Rob Bell's new book, actually, The Green and White One, which is really good. Probably it meant that when you went to market on your way in, you sort of, you paid a little worship respect to the local gods, and got a little mark on your hand. Stamp. I don't know how they did that. A bit of chalk, perhaps. I don't know. Then you were allowed to trade in the market. But without the mark, you weren't allowed to trade. If you didn't worship the idol, you couldn't get into the market, you couldn't get food. If you did worship the idol, you were saying there are other gods alongside Jesus. So this was like an immediate thing that had consequences
for the people who lived in the Roman Empire. It was an immediate thing that had consequences for the people that lived in Babylon. And in both cases, they're saying, no, we won't do it. We opt out. What else do we learn? And they were focused on what was right, above what was good for their health and the smell of their clothes, of course, that was important. I couldn't find any quote, but probably perhaps because they made it up. But I heard this speaker ages ago. It was talking, I think it was talking from John, but it's certainly not in John. But he said about how Christians are called to do what is good and right and true, which I thought made sense. But he said often we choose what is comfortable, convenient and profitable. And I thought, oh dear, that feels quite true as well. And this was what Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego opted out of. They were willing to take the price and take the hit for what they thought was right above all else. What else do we see? I think it's worth mentioning the obvious. They still had to go in the furnace. At no point was there any sort of sense of we'll pray and God will get us out of the furnace. He'll get us out of trouble. They were thrown in. You know, there was a hot furnace and they didn't know if they were going to be killed. And I don't know what happened to their ropes. Maybe their ropes were burnt off and the rest of them was fine. But I'm imagining they were scared. I'm imagining they weren't thinking, oh, goody, chance to share my faith. Yeah, it's not a great thing. And likewise, if you read the New Testament, we're not promised an easy ride. In fact, it's explicitly written in the New Testament, expect to be persecuted. Expect it to be rough at times. But here, even when their prayers are answered, even when their lives are saved, even when the king ends up saying, I'm not the most important person, there's a most high God above me. Most high God, I haven't thought that. I'm still a God, but there's a most high God. So even when it all works out really well, the best they can hope for, actually, there is still that moment there of fear and trepidation and certainly potential suffering. So what do we learn from them? Well, they saw God as their emperor. They did what was right. But they still had to go through this time where the outcome was not very clear. So what? How do we translate it to us? This is what it's like to live in Babylon. How do we shift that to the UK today? I think there are two things. Oh yeah, there we are. Firstly, in the same sense, as I mentioned before, I think that we need to think about the fact that Jesus is our president. I'm going to stick with president because the options, as I've explained, are not so good. Jesus is our president. Now, we don't live really under a system that is as authoritarian as other systems, and I think that's a good thing. I think that's a helpful thing for us. But we do live in a situation where there are expectations made of us, where there are ways of living that aren't what Jesus would want, I think. I was thinking about this before, and I think in particular expectations about what you do with your money and how you use your time are probably the two biggest things. It's expected that you'll buy a house and spend loads of money on a mortgage. It's expected that you'll buy, you know, the latest entertainment stuff or wear fashionable, reasonably fashionable clothes. I don't even know how I'm doing there, really. It's expected that you'll save money and put money in a pension fund. I don't know how I'm doing there either, actually. Can't think of it. In terms of time, I did jury service earlier on this year. And I teach history and some politics. And for politics, they got in this retired head of politics from another college who was a crazy woman in lots of ways. But anyway, she was talking to me about, she used to do this weekly quiz with her politics students when she did it. And she would, if any of them caught her out on any of the stories, they would get a point. And if they got 5 points in a term, then she'd give them a prize. And she said they never did. Because when I got home, I turned on the news at 6, and I didn't turn it off until I went to bed at 10:00. And I was like, you are crazy. But I didn't say that because she talked a lot and I would never have got away. But the expectation about what we do, I mean, that's an extreme example, obviously, but the expectation about what we do with our time, the amount of time we commit to work, in certainly in teaching, is huge. The amount of time that you might put into or your default options on entertainment in the evening. I know that for me, the easiest thing is to watch some TV. Is that the most healthy or profitable thing? Is that, if Jesus was alive today, how much TV would he watch in the evening? I don't know. Probably less than me, though, I think. So I think Jesus being our president, it's not a simple thing. There's no sort of simple kind of, so what, don't do this today. But there is a kind of a so what. We should be like Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego and Daniel. We should be thinking about what is it what is it that Jesus would be doing? And the answer to that really is getting to know Jesus better. Unless we know Jesus better, we won't know what he would or wouldn't be doing today. Unless we know Jesus better, we won't understand the values that he makes his decisions based on. And the second thing is that it may not be a smooth ride. You might look at things and think, oh, missed my train. Well, actually, maybe you should be missing your train. Maybe that'll cost me some money. Well, maybe Jesus wants it to cost you money. Maybe people will go, oh, you're a Christian. Well, perhaps that's the price you pay for being loyal to Jesus. And I think, I don't know about you, but certainly for me, that is something that that I'm not keen on. And, potentially something that holds me back from being more the person that that Jesus wants me to be. So let's stand up. I've rambled a bit there. So what? Jesus is our president, and it may not be a smooth ride. Let's stand up and...